We're going to go over the symptoms with my guest, Stefan Schwartz, the author of The Schwartz Report, which I highly recommend to everyone. And so just so you know about that, right here at the get-go, you can Google it after the program, S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z Report, and subscribe. It's for free. And what Stefan does is basically, like I do, you might say we're modern hunter-gatherers. We look at the data, you know, the tracks that are happening in the forest, as it were, the patterns that are emerging from what William Grider called in his book, Who Will Tell the People? The Betrayal of American Democracy, the patterns that are within the confetti of, quote, news that we're showered with every day. So what are the patterns? What's really happening in this miasma of information, which only gets greater and greater by the day? People can easily get lost in it and manipulated in the fog. That's what the word benighted means, the benighted population or a population of dupes that can be a description of large parts of people in countries all over the world because they just don't know what's really happening underneath. It's particularly true here in the United States with our president who tweets lies and falsehoods in avalanches every day. And our job here as trackers, if you will, and trend spotters is to actually point out the patterns that are going on underneath, help people connect the dots so they can be discerning and really well-informed citizens in a putative democracy. As we know, we don't have a real democracy here. The Princeton study of 2014 showed irrefutably that we've become an oligarchy and a plutocracy. That doesn't mean that we can't cultivate the seeds of a genuine democracy to go beyond what I'm calling democracy 1.0, which is the structure of governing institutions elaborated by our 1% patriarchal male property owner founding fathers. Their mythology has gotten quite frayed now as it is coming to the end of the normal term of a democracy, which is 200 to 250 years. And what we're going to talk about today is what next? How can we vision and see the seeds today, first of all, of recognizing the decline and demise? Very, very important to get out of the trance that somehow this is just going on forever, the America we knew in the 60s and 70s when we had a middle class, that's just going to somehow magically reappear. No, there'll be huge shifts and migrations of population, whole new ways of doing jobs, whole new ways of creating communities. And Stefan Schwartz is really, in that sense, a national treasure in this regard because every day, practically of the week, he puts forward articles from multiple sources that he reviews that show us what these trends are so that we can actually engage in the interest of our own expression and the interest of the good of a society, as he puts it, of well-being and health and well-being for all. So with that introduction, Stefan, I'd like you to begin by maybe telling people that are not familiar with you, in a sense, who you are. There are many, many things you could say, but, you know, whatever points of reference in your own biography that have led you to the self-appointed task, which is so beneficial in these times.
Wow, that's... let me think here. Well, I have three major trends in my life, or three major sort of aspects. I've been interested in social transformation that produces well-being since I was a teenager. Four times in my life, I've been involved with changing history, the 50s and 60s, the civil rights movement. In the 70s, I was the special assistant to the chief of naval operations. And the task was to transform the American military from the elitist conscription organization, of which I was a vet, into the all the gender and racially blind meritocracy that is the military today. Then in the 80s, the development of what came to be known as citizen diplomacy, a group of us who set up back channels between the Soviet Union and the United States, which became important to both governments. And then through all of that, the what I would think of as the consciousness movement, that is the idea that consciousness is not all physiologically based, that there is a continuity of consciousness, and that all life is interconnected and interdependent. And I'm an experimentalist, so I'm a data person. My interest in politics and religion is only anthropological. I care about it from an anthropological point of view, but I have no affiliation or even a great deal of interest in that personal sense. I just look at data, and you know, it makes life much simpler if instead of listening to political philosophies and speculations and just general bloviation, you actually look at data, because it gives us I think of it as kind of going through a swamp. And if you know how to get through a swamp, if you've ever been in a swamp, you know that there are certain places you can step that are firm and you'll be okay. And there are other places where if you step, you can get sucked into the quicksand or the muck and disappear. So I rely on data. And if you do that, you can see very clearly that the function of the state ought to be to foster well-being, and that contrary to almost everything you hear and everything that's put out by politicians, creating well-being is not only more productive, more efficient, more effective, nicer to live under, and a more enduring set of social policies, but it is also much, much cheaper. Everybody tells you, oh, no, we can't afford that. We can't afford to see that children are properly fed or educated. We can't afford that. I mean, we can afford the military, but we can't afford that. But the truth is that when you look at other countries and what they're doing, you see very quickly that where well-being is the social priority, you have a much happier, longer living, by the way, significantly longer living. A woman in Louisiana has 5 years less life expectancy than a woman in Washington State, as an example. So I believe in the observation Justice Brandeis gave, that the states are really social laboratories. So I spend a lot of time looking at what's going on between states that have red value governance and states that have blue value governance. And I look at a lot of research data that compares what's going on in the United States with what's going on with other countries. And you just cut through all of the gobbledygook about political argument and philosophies and all that, and it makes everything much simpler, because well-being in every way is a more desirable social outcome, and it can be objectively measured. You know, you can take, just take infant mortality, for instance. Or maternal mortality, the mothers themselves. The United States has the worst maternal mortality record in the developed world. A child born in rural America has less of a chance of getting to his first birthday or her first birthday than a child born in Botswana, Africa. So the other problem, of course, is that we constantly lie to ourselves. Our politicians lie to us. The media focuses on whatever is flashy at the moment and basically has two stories a day. But underneath all of that are the real social trends which are shaping the country, and it's those trends that I think we should be focusing on, because that's how, to use your terminology, democracy 2.0 is going to come into being, if it comes into being.
And that's really the key point, if it's going to come into being. One thing you and I, on our different paths, but completely copacetic and in harmony, I too had my original understanding of the purpose of citizenry from childhood, and always had the vision that I was here to serve and to serve in a way that would benefit the public good. All the papers I wrote in college and all of my thinking was in that way. I was in the civil rights movement. I was in the anti-Vietnam War peace movement, the women's movement. I organized the first Earth Day at Harvard on a Woodstock model of bringing in the whole community and not just doing something elite in the halls of Ivy, as it were, with teachers telling us what we needed to know, and on and on and on. My entire life has gone through the same kind of phases that yours has, and particularly this enduring interest in how we fulfill a society of well-being for all, and so people can be self-reliant and generous and in community and have that sense of psychological empowerment. I recall at one point the great Lauren Vanderpost in South Africa was celebrating how he had grown up beneficially in the natural surround. He was a white person, his parents were white, but he was on the periphery of the forest and the Kalahari Desert. And a Kalahari Bushman was his nanny. And she used to share in the kitchen the many, many stories of life its own self that were understood over literally millennia by the Kalahari Bush people. And
the Kalahari Bush people, by the way, I spent 3 weeks with them, and completely changed my life. Before I went over, I worked for National Geographic, and I was doing a research for a piece on the Bushman art. People don't think of that very much, but they left a quite large amount of art in caves and things. And so we were, the Geographic wanted to do a story on that, and I went over to have some interaction with them. And before I went to all the anthropologists. This is back in the early 60s. I went to all the anthropologists who gave me what I came to think of as the Little Brown Brother lecture. These are primitive people. They have no, they don't even own things. They just sort of wander around and they live in this very primitive state, grubbing things out, you know, that that story. So I went over, I flew over to Johannesburg, and then they put me on a little bush plane, and it went up into what is now Namibia, what was then Southwest Africa. And we get to this just out in the woods in the Kalahari, which is kind of not a Saharan desert, but more like Joshua Tree in California, sort of semi-arid. Anyway, so we're there, and this little group of people come out, this little family group. They're small. The Kalahari Bushmen are their own race. They're not Bantus. They're not blacks. They're not white. They're not Hispanic. They're their own thing. So we're going along, and I was, in those days, I prided myself at being very gifted in the woods, and I taught survival, woodscraft, and all that sort of thing. And so I was a bit puffed up, and I was with these people for about an hour when I realized that I was so klutzy that I was literally putting them in jeopardy just because I was such a klutz. And then, but the one that really came along is I had read, you know, I'd been told and I'd read what was available. And I read Lawrence Vanderpost's wonderful book on the Kalahari. That was how I got introduced to him. And anyway, I had brought food because I didn't really want to eat grubs. I had kind of backpacker food. And we're going along, and I was getting kind of hungry, and I looked at my watch, and we walked on a little bit more, and looked at my watch, and John, that was the Caucasian name that he had, the sort of head man who could speak English a little better than anybody else. Some of them didn't have. He looked at me, and he said, "That's a beautiful slave bracelet you have." And I understood that these people were not primitives. They were primitives in a technological sense, maybe, but they were very sophisticated. They were simply sophisticated in a different way. And I never forgot that lesson. There are a lot of ways to be a human being, and the Western cultural approach is a way, not the way. So these people lived, I learned a great deal from them. They were much more in touch and aware of the great meta systems of the Earth than I couldn't even approximate it. I mean, later we flew over where we had walked, and you could see that they walked die straight. They said to me, "We're going to walk over for a couple of days to where the gazelle will be." And I said, "Well, how do you know they'll be there?" "Oh, well, they told us." And we walked a couple of days, and by God, there they were.
So, indeed. Yes.
You know, they just, I realized, and I later had more interactions with the Hopi, for instance, and mm-hmm. with a Shoshone medicine man named Rolling Thunder. And I just came to understand that there are a lot of ways to be a human being, and that making easy judgments about primitiveness and stuff is really delusional. That every form of human culture has something to teach us. And that we need to look at it not from the basis of making cultural judgments, but instead on the social outcome data. Again, are these people happy? Do they have a fulfilled life? Those are the things that matter, not do you have the latest tablet.
I love it that you're saying the data outcomes. Are these people happy? Do they have a fulfilled life? And without knowing anything about your background in the Kalahari Bushmen, I introduced that spontaneously, as I do in this format of dialogue, where there's no preparation, there's no particular PowerPoints. I don't go through it like Charlie Rose or somebody who has a list of subjects that he wants to cover and will cut off a conversation in midstream to move on to the next point. I'm totally delighted that I've uncovered quite spontaneously this connection you have with the Kalahari. And it is a key to dialogue. This is something that shows that the spirit, the creator spirit that's in all of us and in the entire universe, as the native understanding, including the understanding of the Kalahari, all the indigenous people understand that we live in a fully alive, conscious universe where the stars themselves have consciousness. Vedic astrology knows that your birth date and the alignment of the stars has an energetic, a consciousness energetic that in a sense offers you a certain life path because of the constellations of the different energies in the stars that you will go through as you advance in days, months, years, and so on. The people in Australia understand the song lines and the living aspect of the earth itself, just like Ramana Maharshi did on Mount Arunachala in India, that many people from an indigenous point of view say that there is an intelligence that's in the universe that has a hierarchy, and we are at the lowest rung. In other words, the consciousness of the cosmos and the consciousness of a mountain or the land itself is more enduring and older than even the cellular manifestations on the land, such as the plant kingdom, and then later the animal kingdom, and then finally the human species. So as you go farther away from the deep inherent wisdom of the cosmos in these life forms, you wind up as a human being really at the level that is most egocentric and as least connected to the entire environment. And Western culture, in a sense, I call it the modern mind, is the acme of that. And we're seeing that right now in America in particular, a sense of tremendous isolation, a sense of tremendous anxiety, uncertainty about the future. How are we going to support ourselves? Where have the jobs gone? Middle-aged men committing suicide in unparalleled numbers because somehow the life that they thought was theirs has disappeared. The sense of lack of any meaningful spirituality, which would be endorsing working for the good of all. Instead, we have what you call, I think quite aptly, Christo-fascism fundamentalism, which is an ideology that couldn't be further from the heart or further from the truth of the lived reality. So when you say, and I thought it was terrific, that all culture is a way, not the way. Well, I would say that modern mind culture is very much away from the lived reality and wisdom of the human species from its indigenosity forward. The anthropologists actually refer to what I say is our DNA, psychic and physical inheritance as human beings. In the beginning, they call it mystical participation, that the very first humans understood and experienced themselves as integrated in a part of a fully conscious universe, like being in a womb. So today we have the Lakota people talking about all our relations and actually experiencing the world that way. And that's what I say in my programs, Living Dialogues, we need to call back. And I want to just say one or two other things about the Kalahari Bushmen and Lauren Vanderpost and why I brought it out. And that is that one of the things Lauren Vanderpost learned from his Bushman nanny was that our story of being a member of a lived community. So I am somebody's brother, I'm somebody's father, I'm somebody's son, this or that in a lived community, like the tribal communities in which the Kalahari Bush people lived, is more important to our well-being and our health and our happiness than is as important and as crucial as food and water are to our physical bodies. So it's our story of being integrated into an alive community. It's been ripped apart by the modern culture and the modern mind, which has now put us in a situation of enormous greed, egocentricity, lack of empathy with the people of the 1%, all proven by psychological studies. Not every single person, but as a class, the people that have made it their business to expropriate and extract money and life-giving work and others, other kinds of energies from the people themselves are really truly unhappy, but the people themselves are getting more and more unhappy. So one very instructive book that could be read, I don't know if you've read this yourself, actually, Stefan, but are you familiar with the book The Bushman Winter Has Come that came out about 3 years ago? Do you know that book?
No, I don't.
Okay, so I'm just going to tell this for everybody and we'll move on with our dialogue. The Bushman Winter Has Come is written by an anthropologist that lived for 7 years, a white man, with the Kalahari Bush people at the very end of their culture's existence, because it's now gone out of existence because it's been forced to, as the Inuits and others, and people in Greenland, to actually become dependent on the modern state because their homeland, if you will, they'll take Greenland as an example, the ice is melting. So literally their land that they live off of is literally melting under their feet, and they're having to, this is an easier example that people can understand as an intermediate observation, they're now wards of the state of Canada. They have no livelihood, and they're incredibly sad. And in the transition, there were times when they actually had to support each other in their outposts because the food was absent with cannibalism of those that died. So in any event, going back to the Kalahari Bushmen, they became forced out of the desert where they were able to survive. One great picture in the film made by Lauren Vanderpost is that he's sitting on his haunches. He's a fully grown man now with a Kalahari Bush person who's dressed only in a tiny thong and has a knife about 3 inches long in his belt. And they're conversing about their understanding of the universe. And the Kalahari Bushman is sharing why they venerate the praying mantis and what they learn from that manifestation. And then he gets up and with great dignity, and he's probably less than 4 or 4.5 feet tall, he walks totally naked into this trackless desert with full confidence that he can rejoin his tribe, which is many, many, many miles away. And he knows how to get there. He knows how to find water. He will rejoin the tribe and so on. So there is this sense of integration with a universe that is no longer there because of climate change, because of what we, the modern people, have done. We've actually destroyed the habitat of the Kalahari Bushmen. So this is an enormously influential book because it took him 35 years, this anthropologist, to ingest and process all of the experience he learned with what he calls the last of our forefathers, the Kalahari Bushmen. So with that kind of background, I think we can now look forward, just zoom, you know, with the magic of time travel into your today's Schwartz report, in which you are coding the demise of the modern mind culture. You have four things today that we can talk about. One is science has outgrown the human mind and its limited capacities to process information. That's on the Alternet. And you say, I agree with this essay and see it as a very important trend. I urge you to read it. Your second one is American elections are a battle of billionaires. We are merely spectators. And that is from The Guardian by David Callahan. And your comment is, this is what Citizens United has wrought. Here's the reality. American democracy is slipping away, and many people don't even seem to notice or care, if they do notice. Your third one is called Survival of the Riches by Douglas Rushkoff, known to many people as a writer, and this appears in Medium. And you say, this is where neo-feudalism goes, another theme that you and I have both talked about independently for years. Neo-feudalism is what's happening to us. This is what many amongst the uber-rich are thinking. It is so utterly wrong, it is hard to know where to start. But this is the direction the new economic aristocracy is heading. This is what is guiding their worldview. And you've commented on this, and I've commented on it, you know, seeking out-of-the-way places where they buy up land in New Zealand and put in heliports so nobody can get to them. And this is where they're going to escape to when the world they've created of extracting resources from everybody else falls apart. You had one about people actually converting missile silos a while back, and that's something that David Baldacci wrote a whole novel about last fall, who's, you know, published, gotten 40 million readers of all his various books. But this is what's happening. And the final thing you talk about is The Enemy in the White House from Der Spiegel. Germany, which has a much more comprehensive and holistic society than we do in terms of health and well-being. And you say, at a time in human history when cooperation on a planetary scale is the only way we will get through what climate change does, Trump is doing everything in his power to break relationships and factionalize humanity. Der Spiegel is one of the most respected publications in Europe, and this is what the United States now looks like in its pages. So we have just a short period of time in this program, but we're going to move on to part two. But for today, we have 3 or 4 minutes left for you to just take a commentary of where you think all these trends may go and a vision for the future.
Well, I think we stand at a crossroads. The 2018 election, in my view, is the most important election in 150 years. If the Democrats do not take the House, and hopefully the Senate, but particularly the House, by the end of 4 years, if they don't take it, nothing will happen to Trump. I think because the pusillanimous behavior of the Republican Congress, I mean, they're so morally bankrupt that I don't think even the stuff that's going to come out of Mueller, unless it's just really so awful, will block Trump completing his first term. And at the end of his first term, the United States, as we have grew up with it, won't exist anymore. I mean, it's hanging by a thread as it is.
Yes.
We, I think, need to make a citizen-based response that requires all of us to participate. I wrote a book called The 8 Laws of Change about how to exactly do this. But very briefly, at the most fundamental level, it gets down to what I call the quotidian choice, which is every day you make hundreds of choices the toothpaste you use, the gasoline you buy, the toilet paper, the food, whatever. You make hundreds of choices. And the quotidian choice pledge is that from this day forward, I will become aware that I am making choices. Most people actually aren't, surprisingly enough. I will become aware that I'm making choices, and of the options that are available to me, I will consistently and universally always choose the one that is the most compassionate, life-affirming, and fostering of well-being. None of the options may be great, but inevitably one of them is always better than the others. And you can, it's not that hard to figure out which one is the most life-affirming and fostering of well-being. And that I will tell 10 people that I'm doing this as a discipline and invite them to join me and in turn ask 10 of their friends. And you can just do the math. We know that whenever 10% of any cohort, whether it's a church group or a school committee or a nation, whenever 10% of the cohort shifts in consciousness, the entire cohort has to accommodate for that. Mm-hmm. So we really, I think, are at a place where it's not only required that we vote, but it is also required that we consistently, individually make choices that support and foster well-being. And you can see this, how this happens. Yeah.
And at this point, unfortunately, we're going to have to interrupt Stefan Schwartz, and we'll go directly to the BBC and World News. And be with us next time as we continue our conversation with Stefan Schwartz.
Unleashed legal uproar, with several other justices moving to block the decision. Daniel Galas is in Sao Paulo.
A clash between judges in Brazil is causing legal uncertainty over what will happen to former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, known as Lula. A judge said on Sunday that Lula must remain free as he appeals against his criminal conviction in higher courts. But a few hours later, another judge overseeing the case said there is no legal reason to set Lula free. Lula was sentenced to 30 years in prison for his role in a corruption scandal involving a construction company and was jailed back in April. Despite his criminal conviction, he is still campaigning in Brazil's presidential elections and currently leads most polls.
The first boys have been rescued from a flooded cave system in Thailand, where they had been trapped for 2 weeks. Four were brought out in an operation involving 90 divers. The boys are now in hospital. The complicated operation of two divers escorting each child through submerged and narrow caves didn't take as long as expected. But as Dan Johnson explains, this was a test of the rescue method.
It is an incredible feat. It's giving everyone here a positive feel that this is possible, that they can bring all these people out safely. There are 18 specialist divers who've been guiding the boys out. It takes many hours just to get one boy to the exit of the cave. So it looks like they've taken the decision that they've done as much as they can for today. Everyone needs to take a rest so that they're not doing this job when they're too tired. And we're told they will come back fresh in the morning to start this operation again at about 8 a.m.
The leaders of Eritrea and Ethiopia, Isaias Afewerki and Abiy Ahmed, have announced practical initiatives to help end the bitter conflict that's beset the two nations for 20 years. But Ahmed has promised to accept the recommendations of an international boundary commission. Here's Emmanuel Igunza.
In speeches broadcast live on state television, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and Eritrea's President Isaias Afewerki said they had agreed to set up embassies in their respective capitals and resume flights between each other. Landlocked Ethiopia will be allowed to use Eritrean ports on the Red Sea, while direct phone connections will also be restored. Eritrea won independence from Ethiopia in 1993, but within 5 years, the two countries were at war over the town of Badme and a surrounding triangle of barren land.
A train is derailed in a rural area of northwest Turkey. Local media are reporting that 10 people have died and more than 70 people have been injured in the incident in the province of Tekirdağ, west of Istanbul. BBC News. At least 6 members of Tunisia's security forces have been killed in what's been described as a terrorist attack near the Algerian border. The police unit is reported to have been ambushed in the region of Jandouba in the west of the country. There were reportedly fighting militants trying to infiltrate across the border when they were killed. A teenager in Iran has been detained for posting hundreds of videos of herself dancing in Iranian and Western styles on social media. Madeh Hojabri, who's 18, is since reported to have been released on bail. Sebastian Usher reports.
Madeh Hojabri is one of a number of young Iranian women winning sizable followings on social media, with home videos showcasing dance or fashion. But the Iranian police are intent on stopping them. 2 days ago, Iranian state television broadcast a programme in which several young people, including Madeh Hojabri, were shown confessing to breaking the country's moral code. It's not clear if their statement